When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 3, season 2 of In Conversation with Ashwin. And today's episode really talks all things water. Our guest for the show today is Abhishek Narayan. Abhishek and I go way back to maybe 2010, 2011, when we were in school debating on stage in these inter-school cultural fests. All around a great chap, intelligent, funny, happy-go-lucky, but also very dedicated about what he does. Abhishek Narayan is a researcher at EWAG, which is the Swiss Water Institute. And his research focuses on planning water, sanitation, and solid waste in the context of low and middle income countries. He holds a PhD from ETH Zurich and a master's from Oxford University. Abhishek's experience includes working with the World Bank, the Rockefeller Foundation on projects in South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. His transdisciplinary work has been in collaboration with several international organizations, including the UN, the World Bank, Asian Development Bank, Swiss and German agencies for development, and the Gates Foundation. He was also the co-founder of the Swiss Water Partnership Youth. He's held advisory and board positions in Swiss Water Partnership, One Water, UNSDG on cities, and International Water Association. He's a visiting guest lecturer at Oxford, EPF Lausanne, hope I'm saying that right, Delft, and TU Munich. He's also recipient of the Green Talents Award, Commonwealth Scholarship, St. Gallen Leader of Tomorrow Award, and is also a World Economic Forum Global Shaper. Man, Abhishek, you make all of us look stupid. Anyway, without further ado, I hope you guys enjoy listening to this 40-minute episode. I absolutely had a blast recording it. Abhishek, thanks for being on the show, man.
Thanks so much, Ashwin. Always a pleasure talking to you. And I'm also glad that you restarted the podcast.
Yeah. When I have so many cool people around me doing cool things, it's easy to get back in the flow. So, in fact, our conversation in Toronto motivated me to get you on the show. So thank you for being on it. First question. Tell us a little about your early childhood and how that has influenced the person you've become and are becoming.
I was born and raised in Chennai, you know, the city that both you and I come from. And typically, I would go on to say, you know, I was raised in a middle-class family and so on. But the very fact that I went to an English-speaking school and with the latest statistics that came through, I understood that we were all severely privileged and we don't really have the rights to call ourselves middle-class, actually, in the context of India. But I guess for the sake of the narrative, it's just to say that we had some privileges and, you know, the values that, you know, the parents asked us to have in ourselves and what the teachers kind of tried to inculcate in us was pretty standard, right? You know, study well, that's your path to success. And of course, there was some extra things that were always valued, which was do some sports. And in my case, I was into badminton and rowing. Chennai being a city of cultural inclination within the Indian context meant that music and Carnatic music and dance and these were things that were quite visible all around us. And of course, we were always encouraged to do some social slash leadership activities. So, you know, clubs, doing some volunteering for the environment, for social causes, these were all commonplace. And I think when I was looking back, I seem to have done fairly well in some of these aspects. But there were some already inherent predilections that I had for certain topics, for certain subjects. And it's interesting that this question comes now because a week ago, I was on a bike trip just around my birthday. I took a week off to start biking by myself, and I was reflecting on these questions.
Where was the bike trip? Like, and how long was it for?
So I started where the Rhine River started, and then that's...
And for context, you live in Switzerland, right?
Oh, yes, that's true. Yes. So the Rhine River starts in one of these mountain passes called Oberalp Pass. And then I followed it for 5 days, roughly around 500 kilometers, ending in the city of Basel, where the Rhine River leaves Switzerland onto Germany.
Wow. How was that?
Yeah. It was really an experience. It's my first such trip. And doing it alone meant that I had quite some time to reflect, especially since it was around the 30th birthday. So it was special.
Love it.
Yeah.
And love birthday rituals, right? That's
absolutely
so nice. Okay. Yes. What did you introspect and what was the biggest learning from that trip?
Yeah. So it was basically looking back at life and then trying to understand what my values are today. And that's what I was trying to bring up, which was, you know, in school, especially, you know, you and I went to similar schools. And actually, for those people listening, that's where Ashwin and I know each other from for the first time. Because schools in Chennai have this very unique sort of an inter-school competitions / culturals, as they were called. And through that, we were exposed to oratorical skills, cultural skills, music skills, etc. And I found myself particularly interested in some of these speaking events. So it could be Jam and Shipwreck and things like that that are quite, I guess, endemic to Chennai, but also larger things like Model United Nations, debating and quizzing. And so these were all the things that I found myself quite inclined towards and engaging with. And then recently, you know, when I did this bike trip, but also in the past in some leadership coaching, I tried to understand what my strengths are. And then some things that came up through these exercises were, you know, communication, connecting with people, breaking down complex topics into simpler arguments, and of course, just being curious about a myriad of different topics. When I was thinking of, if these are my strengths, where did I actually pick up these skills or were they just inherent to me? And it occurred to me that a lot of these were fostered in those schooling times through these different activities that the schools gave us exposure to. I think they were truly a formative period. And that has really shaped the way in which I approach any problem-solving exercise today.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I remember for a long time we competed on stage in those Jam and Shipwreck events, and you know, it was so healthy in terms of competing. But it also, like in Chennai, you get so competitive, right? So, did you have a lot of that spirit growing up? You were happy competition, or was it like, oh no, I got to win at any cost? Competition.
No, I agree with you that it was fairly healthy competition, because whether you win or lose, it didn't really make or break anything.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, when we were in high school and we were aspiring for, you know, higher education, you know, getting into the top universities or colleges, it was not these awards or these prizes or these competitions that were really valued, which again brought a whole different perspective to me, which is that unlike in the US or perhaps in several universities in Europe, the transition from school to university in India and in Chennai were purely based on academic credentials, which of course is a double-edged sword, because for many of our peers or many others, sports or culturals or social leadership skills, etc., were not really of great value, because you finished your 12th grade and then you were immediately evaluated on an academic basis to get to the next step.
Yeah, and also India has that reputation of being an academic factory in some sense, right, in terms of being very grilled in on the quant and the science aspect of it. Obviously, notwithstanding that, there's immense talent as well. But the academic reputation that India has is obviously more more average than most other nations. The expectation from an Indian school graduate is that, hey, you better be really good at math and science.
That's really an interesting sort of a proposition, right? That because most of us who have sort of moved to countries in Europe and North America and probably Australia, etc., a lot of the peers that we see are those who did really well in academics and kind of moved out. But I was just recently listening to another podcast with Amit Verma and some of his guests, which basically said that in India, there is this 5% of graduates who are really excellent at a global level, really excellent. But the rest, the academic system and the education that has been provided through early childhood, through a high school and university, has been fairly poor, because by several metrics, whether it's the OECD metrics or whether it's certain Indian-owned metrics that like AXRA that does these surveys, show that 2 out of 5 people in high school are not able to solve primary school math and science and English skills. So this also, again, reemphasizes the point that I have been time and again thinking about recently, which is the immense privilege that some of us have had growing up in India, but never really recognized it while we were there. Because most others, you know, who don't have this privilege were mostly invisible.
It's so true, because when you started off saying you grew up in a middle-class family, but, you know, that's not painting the picture of the privileges that you were having access to, and that was so responsible of you to point that out, right? Because we need to check our privileges, especially privileges relative to the city, place, and people you grew up with.
Exactly.
Okay, on to the next question. You and Adyar, the Adyar River, a water body in the state that we grew up in, have a really cool story. So tell us a little about that. Tell us a little about what got you into water, and like, you did a PhD in water science. So yeah, where did it all begin, and specifically with the Adyar River? Would love to hear it.
Thanks. As I mentioned, you know, I was doing some sports. So one of it was rowing. So I was into it competitively, rowing at the Madras Sport Club. And Chennai has 3 rivers. The Adyar River, which is well known. The Kuam River, which is also quite infamous for the fact that it's an open sewer. And then the third one called Kosestalyar, which is fairly in the north of Chennai. So the Adyar River, historically, you know, for context, when the British colonization was still in place and Madras was still a presidency, one of the earliest rowing clubs in the entire world was started in Chennai. So I continued my rowing journey, you know, I was training competitively every morning and evening, especially when it was race and regatta season. I was always in the river. And at the same time, I was also into doing research while I was enrolled for my bachelor's of chemical engineering. There, I was working on these advanced treatment of pollutants in water. And that was merely out of a scientific curiosity. And there happened to be a couple of professors who had open positions for me to come in and work. But there was one particular incident which was really interesting, which is we invited, you know, one of these Olympic champions from Croatia who came to spend a couple of days in Chennai and was hosted by the Madras Boat Club. Here, I had an opportunity to just take him out on one of these boats and row together with him. And at the end of which, you know, after the rowing outing, we had a really nice time. And I asked him, hey, how did you find rowing in this river in India? You know, you're clearly an Olympic champion. So you've really seen many, many different water bodies across the world. What did you think? And he said something really interesting. He said, hey, this is one of the best rivers that I've rowed in, because going downstream and upstream was almost exactly the same. So there was not so much flow. So that's excellent for rowing. And, you know, the river is fairly calm. So, you know, you're not splashing and you're not hitting the waves, etc. So that was great. And I said, oh, I'm really happy to know that, you know, someone like you is singing praises about this small rowing club and this river. And then he went on to say, but, you know, it's unbelievable that you Indians have kept this river in such a polluted state, that you have such an amazing resource right in the middle of the city, and it's an open sewer. And when he said that statement, at some point, something really clicked in my brain, which made the disconnect between how polluted the water is and the fact that I was doing pollution research and water wastewater treatment inside labs. So that's when I started to think that, okay, why not use whatever technologies or whatever scientific advances that we have to potentially, you know, help treat this river. And I guess I was 19 or 20 back then, and I was my very naive self. And around that time, I had this opportunity to then go do an internship in the Netherlands and in Delft. And there I, of course, was matched with a very senior professor, someone who's well known for these kinds of river restoration activities and wastewater treatment, etc. So then I worked with him. We created this sort of a small low-cost reactor of sorts, which using sponge and organic matter eating, you know, these bacteria which can clean water. We used those technologies to come up with something that could help treat the water. And I thought, wow, I've solved this problem. I came back, worked on my bachelor thesis, designed this reactor, made a prototype along with my friend. And then we said, and we tested water from the Adyar River, and it showed great results. And I thought, wow, this is excellent. I have solved the problem. And then I went up to the Chennai Metro and few other places where the authorities who were in charge of the river were placed. And then I took these results and the reactor, and I said, guys, I have the perfect solution. This is going to solve the crisis. And as you can expect, they laughed at me. It's not that those sitting behind the desks were unaware that technological solutions existed. From this experience, what I learned is that we cannot solve a problem with engineering when the problem isn't fundamentally engineering based. That really hit me again, and I thought, okay, so if it's not engineering, what is actually the fundamental problem? Then I, of course, went and spoke to several others, especially Arun from the Environmentalist Foundation of India and many others who have been working on these topics for much longer than I was aware of. And then I understood that the problem is actually social, political, and economical as well, and not just an engineering or a technological problem. So I thought, okay, how do we solve this? The most fundamental thing that we discovered was the lack of connection people living near the river had with the river itself. So there was no use for the river anymore. Therefore, it went into neglect. So we thought, okay, if we have to solve this, how do we do it? And one idea that we ended up implementing was creating a citizen action group called the Clean Adyar Initiative, where we got volunteers to clean up solid waste along the banks of the river, to start putting some focus. And we even tried to make a short film out of this Adyar River that gained quite some visibility among the local newspapers and so on. And soon we got a seat at the table with the Chennai Metro, who were already engaged in thinking about, hey, how do we solve this problem? There was a Chennai River Restoration Trust and so on. So the main thing here was we got a seat at the table where decisions were being made, where master plans for river restorations were being made. So it gave me a completely new perspective on public policy, on urban planning and so on. That's probably the special connection. Yeah.
Is that all on? Until you finished undergrad, were you involved in this initiative, or during,
yes,
like how long was this whole tryst with the river for you?
So this went on for a couple of years. You know, I was into this full time before I understood that I actually don't have all the skills to take this forward. And around that time, you know, I also started thinking about doing my master's. And instead of doing an environmental engineering master's, typically, I went on to pursue an environmental policy based master's, specifically focusing on water. So back, I also had some support with some others who helped me start this initiative in Chennai, which then soon also gave way to a much larger project that the Rockefeller Foundation then funded on the city's resilience, which had a major focus on water once again.
So the Rockefeller Initiative funded a project for you in Chennai?
So the Clean Adyar Initiative, I guess, was one of the starting points for urban water resilience, because around the same time we had the Chennai floods and then soon the droughts, etc. So that all allowed the, you know, the local government and some others who were involved in the initiative to then take the opportunity that the Rockefeller Foundation had, where it selected 100 cities across the world to work on resilience. So for each city, it it meant different things. For Singapore, it was largely looking at social cohesion as a resilience index. And whereas for Chennai, you know, we had water as one of the biggest problems. So that was a sort of a follow-up, I guess.
That's amazing. Fast forward to today. What do you do today in Switzerland, specifically in Zurich?
Mm-hmm. After my master's in the UK, I went on to work in Ethiopia for a bit because they had a project that was looking at how the capital of Ethiopia, which is Addis Ababa, solve its own municipal wastewater problem. So they had some innovations with respect to decentralized wastewater management, and I went there to understand that better. And then I came back to Chennai to try and see if those concepts were applicable here. And by then I was also supporting the 100 Resilient Cities by the Rockefeller Foundation and so on. And then very soon I started thinking that I still haven't gotten all the pieces of the puzzle together, which meant that I understood the engineering piece a bit. I understood the public policy piece a bit, but the other missing piece was really planning, especially cities across the world, which are burgeoning, which are soon becoming mega cities because of migration, because of population explosion, etc. Water is often getting affected. And one of the main reasons why we are not able to handle these challenges from urbanization was because of poor planning. And around that time, I started thinking about opportunities to bring that piece of the puzzle together as well. And I found a perfect fit in Switzerland at an institute called EAWAG, which stands for the Swiss Federal Institute of Water, Switzerland's National Water Research Center. And also I signed up for a PhD at ETH Zurich at the same time.
So you were doing your, is that common though to do like a research job and a PhD? Because I'm assuming PhD itself keeps your hands full, no?
Yeah, so I think I was one of those lucky people who had the opportunity to actually engage full-time on a practical project, because it's still applied research, but get the findings from this project and then write it up scientifically, which allowed me to meet the requirements of a PhD at ETH as well.
It almost sounds like a master plan, but obviously it's been years in the making, right? Because you've been involved in this space ever since you started studying chemical engineering or rowing and having that conversation with the Croatian. That's so cool. Yeah, I love how it comes together. And are you feeling very fulfilled with the work you're doing right now? Where do you work right now? Sorry.
Yeah, so I've continued my position here at the Swiss Water Institute or EAWAG. And here, my job, you know, it's one of the largest water institutes with about 500 scientists working on different aspects of water. While most of these, 95% of these people who are working on water solutions are solving problems of the future. And I always tell them that, hey, I'm actually solving the problems of the past, because we still have billions of people without access to water supply, without access to basic sanitation, with most number of rivers, especially in India. I think 80% of all water bodies are polluted. So these are all problems of the past that are lingering on in the present. And I'm not so interested in, you know, solving how we can recover water from sweat in space stations. There are other people who are working on that. I think those are problems of the future, which I think are less pressing than the problems that motivate me at the moment.
Yeah, and interesting. I'd love to dig into the whole sweat from space stations. That's interesting. Can you explain just water, wastewater, solid waste, in as if you were explaining it to a five-year-old, right? How do you, what is wastewater management? And let's start with what happens after I flush my WC after I've had dinner or something like that, if it's not too gross.
Yeah, sure. It's the common assumption that, you know, we can flush and forget whatever we put into the toilet or the water closet, and then we press that one button or we pull that one lever, it takes care of itself and it magically is sorted out. But that's actually not true at all, right? For most people who are probably listening in, we are privileged to have a water closet in the first place. And what happens is, if you're in large cities, whatever is collected in these water closets or whatever is collected from your shower, from your kitchen, etc., they're all combined into what forms black water, right? And this water is moved through pipes from your houses all the way through the city to what is called as a wastewater treatment plant. And here, you have some kind of filtering process where things that you should not have flushed kind of are filtered. That could include, you know, diapers, or that could include, you know, many movies show that if you want to forget someone or something, you know, you write it in a piece of paper, or you take a trinket from them and you drop it into the closet and you flush. That actually makes a lot of problems for those who are actually working on the treatment plant. So they first try to remove all of these things from the entry of the treatment plant. And then it goes into the treatment plant where you first let things settle down. And then you take that water and you let bacteria, which actually would consume whatever organic matter is flushed. And then we would sometimes recover energy from the process. And then we would clean the water through a series of other steps. It could be filtration. It could be some kind of advanced oxidation methods, etc. And then we finally polish these in a variety of different ways. It could be adding oxygen or ozone to it. It could be adding chlorine to this water. And then guess what? That water goes back into the river, which then is the source for the next city downstream for their drinking water. So water and wastewater are basically two sides of the same coin. Your end of pipe is the beginning of another person's pipe.
And how do I get the water in the city that I live in? So that's coming from another city's downstream.
Very likely, right? For example, you're based in Toronto. And yeah. Toronto, as I understand, gets a large part of its water from the lakes around Toronto. Some of these lakes are protected, where they say, okay, you can't set up industries along these lakes, because then industries would send their sewage and their polluted effluents to these lakes, and then it becomes much harder to remove those items from the source water, right? So typically, any city or any person who gets piped water, you know, somebody is actually doing the process of bringing the water to your house, would get their water from three different sources, one of three different sources, or a combination of three different sources. The biggest source is probably underground water. You know, there's the water table, the groundwater that we have access to, which is one of the cleanest forms of water. The second source that they would tap into would be rivers or lakes, which is fresh water. So again, it requires only minimum amount of treatment to supply to you. And then the third possible source is from seas, from oceans, especially those cities that are water stressed and are have access to, you know, coastal zone. They would get water through desalination, which uses technologies like reverse osmosis to be able to get water. And then, of course, if you're living in rural areas, especially in water-stressed regions, there is a possibility of, you know, merely collecting rainwater directly and supplying for yourself. Or, you know, there are places in Morocco, in Peru, etc., where they're even trying to harvest water from the air, because air also has water vapor, and they would be able to get that.
This underground water, rivers, lakes, seas, oceans. You said the underground water is the cleanest source. But has that obviously gone through a purification process before it's reached the underground, I'm guessing? All that you spoke about before was a process that every water body kind of goes through before it collects water in itself, right?
Yes. So you have some natural purification processes, right? Like there's water that gets evaporated. So the contaminants are probably not evaporated. It's only the water that goes up and then forms rain, and then you get it. So that's why they also say rain is a very clean and pure source of water. But you also have underground water, which is basically rainwater or surface water or other things, which are filtered through several layers of the soil before it reaches this aquifer or this groundwater table. But new research has shown us that these, what we considered as highly pure forms of water, are actually contaminated with emerging contaminants, as we call it in the field, which could be things like microplastics, which could be things like PFAS that's doing the rounds. And these are all persistent chemicals that we as humans have injected into the ecosystem. And therefore, it's now in every form of water source there is. They found these kinds of microplastics in some of the purest glaciers in Switzerland, in some of the most untouched parts in Canada and in the Arctic as well. So right now, to say that there is any form of water that's 100% pure is probably not true anymore.
Except the Lake of Zurich, right? You said I could take a glass of water from the lake and drink it.
You probably won't get sick if you do it a couple of times, but if I do that all the time, at some point I think these microplastics will grow in my body.
So now let's just talk about Switzerland specifically as an example country of managing. Would you say they're ahead of the curve than most countries in managing the flush down from WC to when it's coming to your water bottles?
Yes, to an extent, but primarily because Switzerland is just blessed with a lot of water. It's called the Water Tower of Europe. And Switzerland is also just very rich. So they can get the most advanced technologies and put it in and do things, right? So therefore, because of these two benefits, they are ahead of the curve. But I think the more interesting bits are those countries like parts of India, parts of the Middle East, like Israel, or parts of other places in Europe or the US or Latin America, etc., where with limited resources, people are moving towards looking at water really as a water cycle, you know, trying to think about the circular economy aspects. So one of the projects that we are doing is looking at how can we recover resources, how can we recover water, energy, nutrients from what we flush down, right? It's because wastewater is 99% water and 1% nutrients. It's not really waste at all. The 99% of the water is easy to kind of fathom. The 1%, what is this 1% nutrients we're talking about? It's carbon, which is what we refer to as organic material. And it's nitrogen and phosphorus, which are the things that plants need to grow, which is what we provide as artificial fertilizers for them to grow. So if we can design systems in a way that we can remove 99% of the water for reuse, maybe you don't have to drink it, but perhaps you can flush other things down through the drain instead of using drinking water for flushing. Or we can use that for gardening, or we can use that for washing cars, landscaping, etc., right? And then the 1%, which if we tap into, can help us recover energy. So instead of methane going into the atmosphere, or instead of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere, we can recover them as methane, which can then be used as fuel. And we can remove these nutrients, which can directly be used for fertilizers for agriculture.
Is any country doing this already or progressing towards doing it?
No, absolutely. Many countries across the world where water is becoming a problem for three reasons. Either there is too little of it, so scarcity, or there is too much pollution. Because if these are not treated properly, they would end up going into water bodies like lakes or rivers, and would turn these lakes into, you know, these green algal forms, or eutrophication as we call it. So in order to prevent these issues, countries across the world, including India, Switzerland, Canada, Australia, US, all of these different places in specific cities are doing a lot of recovery of water, energy, and nutrients from wastewater.
And I remember you told me about this project you were working on in Bangalore with some restaurants, and then there was some advancement that you were doing from your job in Switzerland. Like, can you dive into that? Because I found that interesting.
Yeah. So Bangalore is a very interesting case because it's a mega city. There are more than 10 million people living there. And if you ask anybody who New Bangalore from 20 years ago, they would say, no, Bangalore was such a small city. There were only about a couple of million people living there. And it's in the last 20 years that it's seen rapid growth. And because of this rapid growth, a lot of areas in the outer circle of Bangalore started building huge apartment complexes where thousands of people would live. But the city was not able to supply water services to them. So they were not able to put pipelines to send fresh water and put pipelines to take wastewater away for these treatment plants. So at some point, the city said, well, if these big construction companies are building large residential complexes, please go ahead and build your own wastewater treatment as well. So there was sort of a policy change that made even apartments with more than 40 flats or 40 families living in it have the mandate to create a treatment plant within their complex and reuse the water from that, because Bangalore also, like Cape Town or Chennai, is running out of water every other year. So they said, well, you have to reuse the water. So the municipality or the city government transferred the responsibility of water supply and wastewater treatment from the public side and sent it to the private owners of these apartments. So what we had was on paper an excellent policy, which, you know, makes a lot of sense because the city was unable to meet the demands. But in reality, these wastewater treatment plants did not function. Mm-hmm. And they therefore just became sort of holding tanks and sent their wastewater through stormwater drains that ended up in lakes. And Bangalore has 300 such lakes. And if you look up news articles from a couple of years ago, you would see lakes frothing, lakes catching fire, etc., in the news from Bangalore. So we were looking at how do we create an incentive? How do we create a mechanism for monitoring, regulation, and also incentivizing apartment owners to actually treat their water to a good extent where they can actually reuse the water within their premises to flush down toilets, to use it for landscaping and irrigating their gardens, etc. And one interesting policy idea that we had was, which was already, you know, I wouldn't even claim it as an idea that we had, but rather something that was organically happening in Bangalore, where a few apartments were treating their water to high quality and then selling it to places where there was requirement for non-potable purposes, which means water for not drinking and cooking, but water for these other purposes, for cooling towers, for laundry, for construction especially. And then they started making money out of this process. So whatever money that they were spending to operate this treatment plant, they were recovering more or less from these sale that they were doing. Mm-hmm. So instead of water tankers coming with potable water into the apartment, they reduced their demand and started reusing their water within the complex. And whatever extra water they had, they were actually selling it through these same tankers. So we mapped this entire process and we gave some recommendations to the local government. And the local government, and actually when I say local government, in this case, it was the government of Karnataka. After the recent drought earlier in spring this year, they released a policy which allowed and legitimized and legalized this entire process and making them cognizant of what is now called as a wastewater economy that has now come up in Bangalore.
Love that.
There's a long way to go, right? Before these lakes become clean, before we actually have a functional wastewater economy where all the water that's being reused is meeting standards. But it's an excellent framework to work with. And I think Bangalore, being the Silicon Valley of India, will very soon take up this policy innovation and also include tech innovations in it and actually make it quite a functional setup.
Yeah. That's amazing. Last couple of questions. Curious from anyone who's listening, what can we do as just regular citizens who don't know too much about this? Obviously, educating ourselves is probably a first step that I hope most people take, because water is such a scarce commodity. I mean, it's abundant, but good water is scarce, right, just purely because of our behaviors. What can we do on a daily basis to make sure that we're being responsible?
So, again, this would highly depend on which context you live in. Where if you live in Dubai, then I would have a very different set of recommendations to give compared to if you were living in Bangalore or in London or elsewhere. But the fundamental thing that I would say, and this would link back to the first conversation that we had today, is about privilege. The first thing is to understand what are the privileges with respect to water that you actually have. Do you have 24/7 water supply? Do you have a functional toilet? Do you have a functional sort of a solid waste management system? These are all things that I think we need to first recognize as privileges that we have, or in some cases, the lack of. And then once you recognize that these privileges exist, let's also reflect on places where those privileges don't exist. And that could be even within your same city, there might be other places where the same services that you have don't exist. And that's where the first recommendation that I would say is look for platforms and opportunities to help provide those privileges. It could be, you know, volunteering. It could be providing some sort of financial contributions to an NGO that is working along those lines, or to simply bring up these topics in your conversations, because very soon, if enough number of people start talking about it, it will start getting the political attention as well. So I'm not necessarily saying take a board and stand in front of the legislative assembly and protest, but recognize and support in whatever way you can. And I think this is a bit more engaging than just saying stop your tap from running water when you're brushing. I think that's what we would tell third graders. But yeah. I think if we are to make a significant impact on the water ecosystem, that is both water supply and wastewater, but also these urban water bodies that are around you, and look for opportunities to contribute meaningfully, I think that would make the world a water secure one.
That's so nice. Last two questions. If you had one quote for the world to see, if you could put something on a wall, what would it be? And then the second question is, if you had a book that you could give to someone, which book would that be and why?
Okay, that's an interesting question. So for the quote, there's one thing that always lingers on my mind, which is, you can't do everything that the world needs, but everything that you do, the world needs.
You can't do everything that the world needs, but everything that you do, the world needs.
Yes. So I think this is a very powerful quote that shows the magnitude of the problem, and not any one of us can actually solve everything. But even the small bits that we do help make the world better, even within our sphere of influence. And the second thing was the book. So one of my favorite books, something that gave me a lot of clarity on the state of the world, etc., is called Prisoners of Geography. It's by Tim Marshall. And I think this book gives you a fantastic perspective on how any and every crisis around the world is shaped by geography. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the current crisis that's happening in Russia and Ukraine, or with Israel and Palestine, and or even with India and Pakistan, or even with the US and Canada in terms of their shared water resources, it all comes down to, in some form, geopolitics. And a lot of this often happens in a sense, it happens because of water issues. So Mexico and the US too, you know, share a lot of transboundary water that goes from the US to Mexico, and the US uses up a lot of it. And then there's only a trickle left for the Mexican side. It's the same thing that's happening between Ethiopia and Egypt. So the Nile actually starts in Ethiopia and then flows through Egypt. And they have conflicts there. So this is a book that basically showed many of those conflicts and helped me for sure understand why large conflicts in the world happen because of geography.
Amazing. Thank you. Thank you for that. And I had a great time recording this, so I will hit stop now. I really don't have a formal end to the show, so...